Order the House Judiciary Committee at 10 after 1. I apologize for being late. We just got out of a press conference, and so with less than normal preemption here, we're going to talk. We have four members of the committee here, Representative Bundy, James, Rokeberg, thank you, and Green, and we will take up
Rokowitz.
Yeah. Pretty much the same to me.
House Joint Resolution 31st, and then we'll go back to Senate Bill 41. With one exception, we do have a person who is set up to testify on House Bill 207, and so we will take that. But with that, would you introduce yourself, please, and introduce our bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Jeff Logan. I am a legislative assistant to Representative Joe Green, who, as the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, has sponsored House Joint Resolution 30. Mr. Chairman, I know the committee's time is taken with other legislation after this, so I'm going to go through this very quickly. For the record, I would like to make one statement, and that is, Mr. Chairman, in the members' packets, they will find, first of all, a letter dated September 8, 1995, from Governor Tony Knowles to Senator Orrin Hatch. Mr. Chairman, I contacted the governor's legislative office. They assured me that Governor Knowles was still in favor of the creation of a new 12th Circuit, even though this letter is somewhat dated and has the references S-956, which was the bill from the previous Congress to create the new 12th Circuit. This does embody the governor's position, and it would be appropriate to include it in the packet, so I have done so. Additionally, members will find a letter dated September 12, 1995 from titled Department of Law, Office of the Attorney General. I spoke last night with the Attorney General. He apologized for his absence today. It was necessary for him to go to Anchorage today. He assures me that this does embody his position. He does support the creation of the new 12th Circuit, and that the other five attorney generals of the five states that would be in the 12th Circuit also still support the creation of the 12th Circuit. So just so members know why these old letters are in their packet. Additionally, Mr. Chairman, members will find in the packets something that says a bill at the top, or S at the top, and then a bill. This is the draft of S-431, the bill introduced by Senators Murkowski, Senator Stevens, and four other senators from Western states. They did not have the final in the congressional office here in town, but this is the language that the resolution speaks to. And I would note that it has been referred to the Judiciary Committee, where it still resides in Senator Hatch's committee. Mr. Chairman, the committee believes that the SJR 30 deserves the committee support because, first, the Ninth Circuit is too big to meet Alaska's needs, and it is too backlogged. In the resolution itself, the whereases, for the most part, are obvious, self-evident, or common sense. The first resolution states that Alaska is in the Ninth Circuit. The second, whereas, states the names of the states and the federal territories in the circuit. The third states that Senator Stevens and Murkowski's have introduced S-431. The fourth, whereas, states that Portland and Seattle will be the headquarters for the new circuit. Mr. Chairman, I might point out this was included in the resolution because 2 years ago now, under the old legislation that Senator Hatch introduced, two states, Arizona and Nevada, agreed that they wanted also to be in the new 12th Circuit, and in exchange for their support for the bill, they wanted Phoenix to be the headquarters for the new court instead of Portland and Seattle. So we have specifically stated in the resolution that that's where the headquarters will be. On the page 2, it states that there would be five states in the new 12th Circuit. The second whereas states that the court is California heavy. Indeed, of 28 judges in the Ninth Circuit, 19 have duty stations in California. Most of them live in San Francisco and Los Angeles. And the rest, basically, Mr. Chairman, just states obvious whereases of why we should support this legislation. And I'll stop now and answer any questions and hopefully be able to answer them and be done within your time schedule.
Let the record reflect that Representatives Porter, Kroc, and Berkowitz have joined us. And Are there any questions?
I,
yes, Representative Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I clipped for a federal judge, not for the Ninth Circuit, but for the district court in Alaska. We had this running debate on this. This always seemed like a good idea to me. His concern always was that, to some extent, we're a medium or small-sized fish in a big pond, that we're part of a powerful circuit, and through that power we can assure ourselves of more of a voice. And it wouldn't be fair to Judge Fitzgerald to let it go by without asking you for your response on it.
Mr. Chairman, not having the legal experience necessary to get in depth into the answer to that question, I think the representative, you stated exactly the reason why this has been introduced and why Senator Stevens and Rakowski have introduced the bill in the U.S. Senate, is that we are a small fish in a big pond, and because of that, we don't get the attention that we need.
Moving to
Representative Croft.
I guess his concern, stating an opponent's concern is sometimes tough, but that if we move to a smaller pond, that pond wouldn't get noticed. Maybe the pond analogy doesn't work, but that the Ninth Circuit, because of its power, gets a fair amount of attention. You just don't think we get enough attention within the Ninth Circuit.
Representative James?
Well, I'll wait till he answers
this. All right.
It was sort of a question, though.
Mr. Chairman, I would defer to the Chairman or Representative Porter.
Well, I suppose that there is some merit to what you say. However, when the backlog shows that the majority of the backlog resides in the state where the headquarters are, so to speak, that we are way far removed, and so our cause is pretty much lost in the large population down there. And so while we may not have, with this new district, the same size as hopefully old District 9, still I think to be heard more often in a smaller district certainly bodes better for the state of Alaska. And I think Representative James and then Porter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, on that point, sorry.
Go ahead.
On that point, I would say that the decisions rendered by circuit courts and the weight of authority they're carried nationally depends on the quality of their decisions, not the location of where they're at and their size.
Representative James.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And on that point, quite frankly, I don't care about how much attention we get elsewhere. I care about what attention we have here at home. But I think that aside from the fact that they're backlogged, it is a huge area. There are lots and lots of cases. I think it does, and also to put in a little aside about my lack of faith in the judicial system, which embarrasses me to say that, but the reason that I say that is that because I in evaluating cases, whether they're a case and I'm involved in or not, whether they're in the Ninth Circuit or elsewhere, I find that there is a lot of decisions that are based on other than the law and on public attitudes and where we are in a society. And I've always judged that this court law decisions ought to be based on the law. And so when we see those decisions coming out of a case where most of the judges are in California, I find very little in common with California. And therefore, if they make decisions at all, influenced whatsoever by the area in which they live and the news they hear every day as to what is happening in society, I feel left out. And I think if they could move that closer this way in the states that we have more in common with, that we have a chance to be recognized more fairly and according to the law, which is what I have complete resistance. I mean, I would lay myself on the court floor probably and say, you know, serve me by the way the law serves me, but please don't serve me by the way you like to eat for what you like to eat for breakfast. And so I think this is in the best interest of us. But the backlog, of course, is another thing that is a deterrent to us getting prompt service from the court. And I think, quite frankly, the court is prone for vision because of its size and backlog alone.
Thank you. Having lived in California for 16 years, about the only thing I have in common with them now are oranges and avocados. Representative Porter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Excuse me, I apologize for being late, so I imagine that Jeff has mentioned that we did this same bill last year, and I think it was unanimous. And as last year's sponsor, the research that I did indicated all of it has been said. Some of the decisions that have come out of the Ninth Circuit elitist group in San Francisco made it plainly obvious that they knew nothing about this state, cared nothing about this state, and thought perhaps we were analogous to Iowa in 1850 or something. Really ridiculous. And to the extent, Representative Croft, that they are a large circuit, getting a lot of attention. That's true. They've been reversed more than any other circuit. That's not the team I want to be on in the first place. So.
Representative Berkowitz.
Maybe I can wrap Representative Cross Pond back in here. Is that I just, having grown up in the shadow of the Ninth Circuit, literally, I don't think they know much about frozen ponds. And this is one of the problems they have down there. But I would also tell Representative James that I'm sure the judiciary has the same respect for the legislature as.
Representative Croft.
Yeah. Why not Hawaii? Why not Hawaii? Looking at the number of states.
I'm voting for Hawaii.
Mr. Chairman, the original idea was to have, in essence, a Northwest court, because there are so many social and cultural and economic similarities, along with geographic similarities, between those five states.
We have a common trade group, even. Yes, Representative Berkowitz.
I've lived in some of the other parts of the country, and the complaint is it's not particular to Alaska that the Ninth Circuit's too large. And I think a lot of the circuits are far too large. When you look at the District of Columbia, has two all by itself. And they're roughly population equivalent to us, and maybe we ought to be pushing for our own Court of Appeals.
Representative Bundy.
I'd like to move this bill or this resolution forward.
Chairman, excuse me. I thought, are we still in the public hearing on this bill?
We have two people to hear from.
Right.
We have one person. I'm sorry. If we have no other questions, on teleconference from Anchorage, we have Joanne Grace.
State regulation at issue defines rural as it is generally understood in Alaska to mean the bush. It did so by excluding areas characterized primarily by a cash economy and thus excluded the Kenai Peninsula. The court vehemently rejected this interpretation, calling it unusual and exotic. The court said, quote, the state's definition would exclude practically all areas of the United States that we think of as rural, including virtually the entirety of such farming and ranching states as Iowa and Wyoming. The term rural is not difficult to understand. It's not a term of art. It is a standard word in the English language commonly understood to refer to areas of the country that are sparsely populated where the economy centers on agriculture or ranching. The court completely rejected the possibility that rural might mean something different in Alaska, the only place where ANILCA applies, than it does in the Midwest or West. Another concern that the Attorney General has is the untimeliness of decisions that come from the Ninth Circuit. This is due in part to the volume of cases in court here, but it's also escalated in Alaska's case because of the court's oral argument calendar. In general, the court hears argument each year 12 times in San Francisco, 12 times in Pasadena, 12 times in Seattle, 6 times in Portland, 2 times in Honolulu, and 1 time in Anchorage. A panel of 3 judges travels to Anchorage each year in August to hear Alaska cases. As a result, the court saves Alaska cases for its annual trip, so that while a case from California may be set for argument a month or two after briefing is complete, Alaska cases generally are set for argument in August, even if briefing is complete in January. This creates an unnecessary delay for Alaska cases. In conclusion, Alaska and the other states included would benefit from the creation of a 12th Circuit comprised of Northwestern states, because the 12th Circuit Court judges would not bring a foreign perspective to their decision. Thank you.
I see no questions. Joanne, could you fax a copy of your testimony, please?
You bet.
All right. Is there any other discussion? If not, what's the wish of the committee?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes,
I'd just like the opportunity to say that I was real pleased to hear this last testimony because it merely corroborates my understanding of the fact that whereas I did have an opportunity to attend law school, it was in the state of California. And whereas my career in law school wasn't as fruitful as those of my colleagues in this committee, I was better served by other things, but that's a different story. But nevertheless, I want to point out the fact that the school I did attend was in California, and clearly the understanding of the California ethos as it relates to law does not serve our purpose as well in the state of Alaska. Clearly, for example, I would suggest that anything that relates to Indians or Native Americans in California is probably focused on whatever happens between Hollywood and the San Fernando Valley, and more relates to cowboys and Indians than other issues. So, therefore, Mr. Chairman, I strongly support this resolution.
Thank you, Representative Roper. Representative Bundy.
I would like to say amen and move this bill.
Appreciate that. Is your recommendation to move it with individual recommendations and zero fiscal?
You capture the essence so well.
Is there objection? The bill is moved from committee. Thank you very much, members of the committee. Amen. We, for anyone who may have come in late, we have a problem, as most of you are probably aware. We will be taking a recess to attend the ward funeral, and so we will be shutting down at 2:15 and reconvening at 5:30. So we will, because of that, I am going to depart a little bit. Just introduce one of the bills that was scheduled today. Take two people's testimony, and then we will revert back to House Bill or to Senate Bill 41. 207. Would you identify yourself?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Jeff Logan, legislative assistant to Representative Joe Green and sponsor of this bill. Mr. Chairman, just as a way of introduction, so you can get on with the testimony, I'd appreciate it if the committee would allow me to come back after the testimony and after SB 41 to give a more complete introduction. House Bill 207 offers certain limited immunity from lawsuit in exchange for the employer developing a written drug testing plan and policy. Last year, or earlier this year, we received a letter, a number of legislators received a letter from a gentleman in Anchorage who is a member of a national association. And that association has model drug testing legislation. The sponsor requested of his staff that his staff research what legislation was out there or what legislation had been introduced on drug testing. We discovered that indeed there had been a bill last year, House Bill 522. We discussed with the sponsor of that legislation whether or not they intended to reintroduce that legislation. They informed us that they did not. And so we looked at the old House Bill 522, modified it, discussed it with employer and employee groups, and came up with House Bill 207. And with that, I'd like to stop and give a bit more of a complete description at a later time and allow you to take the testimony now.
Appreciate that very much, Jeff. On teleconference, we have two people in Anchorage. First one is Frank Dillon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Frank Dillon, and I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Trucking Association, which is a 38-year-old trade association made up of truck users from all over the state. We support House Bill 207 and would like to see this speedily passed through the legislative process and implemented. We see this as a tort reform bill, and I say that in deference to my friends on the committee that have a real interest in the legal aspects of this. We see this as a tort reform bill. The good part of tort reform that Representative Berkowitz and I have spoken about, we believe that this assigns the blame responsibility. And if there is a problem and there has been damage done, then the person who is basically responsible for that damage incurs the liability. Seems logical to us, seems reasonable to us, and we would hope that you would support this bill.
Are there any questions? Yes.
Representative Berkowitz. Frank, I'm consoled somewhat by the fact that while you're chasing me down the highway in your truck, you're not going to be under the influence of anything.
that.
No.
Any other comments? We also have there Matthew Fignani.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Matthew Fignani, and I'm currently president of All West Laboratories, a third-party drug and alcohol program administrating company that coordinates drug and alcohol testing programs for more than 1,400 companies. I also currently serve as a board member for the National Organization of the Substance Abuse Programmers Administration Association, which is an organization to promulgate good policy and standardized policies throughout and proper procedures throughout the nation. There are several hundred members nationwide involved in that organization. This legislation is necessary to establish policy for drug testing. Currently, there are more than 53,000 Alaskan individuals in mandatory drug and alcohol testing by a federal government during the trucking association, by the truckers, the U.S. Department of Transportation Industries, Coast Guard, airlines, pipelines, and trucking industries, to name a few. This number does not include all the non-mandated testing, for instance, that's done at Alaska Ski Resort, or the many hotels, the Westmarks, the Hiltons, the Sheraton Hotels, restaurants themselves. So I would estimate that the number of Alaskans covered by mandatory drug testing is closer to probably 75 to 80,000 Alaskans statewide. When you look at our state's population, that's a huge chunk of our state population in a program where we have no state guidelines as how employers are supposed to establish testing programs. This legislation will assist employers in establishing policy by mandating DHHS or SAMHSA certified laboratories or CAP certified laboratories being used. It establishes policy to have a standardized collection procedure. It establishes policy to use a physician in the event of a positive test result. This is good legislation that helps protect the employer as well as the employee by allowing the employees the right to know what is expected of them through the vehicle of the employee policy. This is this is good legislation. This is a type of legislation that has no fiscal note. It's a voluntary program. It does not mandate, or so it's not an unfunded mandate by the legislature. This is good legislation, and as an aside, I will be back for the 5:30 testimony, just in case you do have additional questions as you think about them throughout the day. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for allowing me to speak.
Thank you, Matthew. Are there any questions? Yes, Representative Berkowitz.
Yes, thank you. I do have a question. The testing that's done for the 75,000, is that done up here in Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative Berkowitz. No, that's not. Currently, there are no operators doing testing in the state of Alaska, except for Alaska Regional Hospital, where they just do the screening test. All confirmations of positive are applied to a DHHS certified lab. Currently, just as an aside, we do over 30,000 tests a year, and the lab we use has conducted over 2.5 million tests since 1989, and they're just a small regional lab nationwide.
Hello?
Well, is there any reason why we can't do them up here? I mean, it seems to me we're generating an awful lot of tests.
If there is. It's volume. We're really not a lot of tests. The lab that we use out of Salt Lake City, Utah, does about 1,000 tests a day, 25,000 tests a month. All of my volume, and I consider myself to be the largest in the state providing this, would represent 1 month testing to a lab of their size, and they're not large by national standards. We used to be a drug testing laboratory here in the state. We actually had technicians, we had the equipment, and we since donated all that to one of the local schools, all of our lab equipment. There just isn't the economy up here to make it worthwhile. Alaskans are price sensitive. Tests right now cost a trucker $60 for a test, and that's to cover all the costs, including shipping to the laboratory in the lower 48. If we did that same test here, we would probably be in the $150 category, because you'd have to have a PhD toxicologist, which there's only a handful of them anyways, is looking at $1.5 million startup just to be a DHHS certified lab. And that's just the startup. So it's just cost prohibitive. Believe me, we did look at this very seriously under our old ownership.
Representative Port.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I should put on the record, I don't think it's a conflict, but just for reporting that I operated a security business for 3 years that, among other things, administered drug testing for several companies in Anchorage. And we also looked into the notion of performing the ultimate test up here, and it is cost prohibitive. You need a huge volume to be able to pull it off.
Thank you. I think that certainly wouldn't disqualify you from voting, but thank you for putting that on the record.
No, you have to vote.
Huh?
It wouldn't.
Huh?
You have to vote.
Okay. That's right.
Wait a second.
Any other questions? Thank you very much, Matthew.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, whoops. We do have one. Representative Rokeberg.
Mr. Fagagnani, have you seen the committee substitute?
Yes, I have. I believe Representative Green's office did fax it to me. I do have it in front of me.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much, and we'll see you at 5:30.
Thank you.
That then brings us back to Senate Bill 41, the self-audit bill. And we will, as I say, work on this till 2:15 and then reconvene at 5:30. And I apologize to both the people in the gallery as well as the committee that we have gotten ourselves behind, not by our own device, but we've missed 3 days in the last 2 weeks due to circumstances beyond our control, and we are getting quite a backlog toward the end of session. So with that, we have closed to have public testimony on this bill, and we have a plethora of amendments, most of which have been included that we discussed. If you'll recall, we had a representative from DEC that went through the majority of these, and we have incorporated essentially all of those, as best I can figure out, in a CS. And that CS is before us. Has anybody, or has everybody?
That K.
That would be H. K, I'm sorry.
And do you have any, have any of these amendments left out that were not incorporated in the CS?
Yes. There are two in the package of nine, and there are a few others that have been added that have not been included in the revised version. Two of those were controversial, numbers
3 and 9.
3 and 9, thank you. And we will discuss those at length. The others, if it's the wish of the committee, we can go through the others that were not controversial, most of them having to do with whether it's government or government agency or whether municipality would also be involved. They're rather minor, and we also have two amendments from Representative Berkowitz, and those have not been included.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Crawford.
As I understood it, the committee's prepared a CS and then it adopted a number of those?
Yes, that's what I mentioned just a minute ago. Version K is the CS that has adopted seven of the nine that were in the package.
Right.
Oops. I guess.
How are you going to handle this? You want to go through this? Yes.
We can go through those if that be the wish of the committee. We can either have. We can either have the. I see we have a member of DEC here to do that, or we can have. We can go through them after this. Whatever's. There may. Yes. You want to speak to those? All right.
Perhaps a brief description.
Yes.
Might expedite matters if we could for the record.
We can very definitely, and as you can see, they're tabbed on my copy. Yes, and they will go quickly because most of them, quite often, they're repetitive. But if you,
Mr. Chairman, I'd move the House Committee substitute for the Committee substitute of the Senate Bill 140, 0LS099-K, Lauterbach 4897.
All right, as our working document thing. Is there objection to adopting the K version? Hearing none, that is the bill before us then. And if you would lead us through those changes.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mike Pauley, staff to sponsor Senator Lehman. As Chairman Green stated, there were nine amendments. Of those nine amendments, only amendments numbers 3 and 9, as they were designated on Monday, were what we would consider controversial. The other seven amendments are amendments that the sponsor, the administration, and affected industries have all reviewed and are fine with. So based on that, I'm going to just be exceedingly brief in describing them, because some of those changes are they're beyond technical. They even get into just, you know, grammar type questions. But the substantive changes are all on page 10 of the, and I'm referring to the K version of the bill, page 10. Starting on lines 3 through 6, where you see a letter B, the wording of this paragraph was changed slightly. It used to contain the words repeatedly or continuously committed, and those words have been dropped and replaced with the word pattern at the end of line 4. And this was just to try to address the concern that some industries have that certain violations are measured for each day you commit them. Like you have a piece of machinery that's not set at the right setting. Well, it's a violation each and every day that it's not set right. And only one compliance issue is involved. But I mean, if it was set wrong for 6 months, you're in real trouble. So the idea was that the word pattern was a little bit more accurate than the word repeated. And as I said, this is something that the administration, the sponsor, and industries are all comfortable with on this. The second change is on lines 10 and 11. On line 10, the word authorized was added, the violation with authorized or committed intentionally. And this is just getting to the thing of, you know, maybe the owner or operator didn't literally commit it, but he or she authorized someone else to do so. And then in line 11, the word recklessly has been added. Previously, it just said intentionally or knowingly, and we've added the reckless concept to this. Okay, and the third and final substantive change I'll call your attention to is starting on line 21, also on page 10, The letter B is new. There is no immunity under this section from an administrative or civil penalty for the violation of an administrative or court order or for violation of a term or condition of an administrative or court order. And what this is getting to really is you do an audit, you find a problem, you report it and claim immunity for it, but that same problem was something that 6 months before you had started the audit report was the subject of an order where they had said, you know, you've got to clean this up, you've got to fix it, whatever. You can't claim that that was an unknowing violation or that was a violation you just discovered if it had been the subject of an enforcement order 6 months earlier. And so that just, you know, kind of clarifies that element of the bill. And with that, like I said, there are some other changes that are just largely of a technical nature, and unless the committee wishes, I think in the interest of time. And
I would amend your one statement because it caught me, perhaps just because I overlooked it. C, actually in the new version, was B, so that there is still a mitigation. It's just that there was a new B put in.
Yes, that is correct.
And the rest of that section is the same as it was.
That's correct.
Are there any specific questions? There are several, as I said, word changes where they expanded from a single municipality, for example, or they might refer to an agency. They've modified that now to include, where appropriate, municipalities as well and departments. But those are they're a consequence. I don't want to belittle them, but they're not a tremendous subject. Any other questions you may have about this group of amendments, which now makes K different from H? That does not mean that all the amendments have been answered.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman,
yes.
Would you like a motion to use that as a document, or did
we've already done
that? We did that already.
It is the document before
it
us.
It is. Okay.
And there was no objection to that. Is there any objection to what has been covered by the sponsor? Moving on, then, in that sequence, we would come to amendment number 10, and that's an amendment sponsored by Representative Berkowitz, and it's H3 Lauterbach 4897.
I've got more amendments in and kind of
the appeals.
Yeah, it's going to be.
It's going to be a little difficult, I apologize, because they came in at different times.
I know, they're not. Most of them I have aren't numbered.
This is H3 Lauterbach?
This is H3
Lauterbach.
Representative Berkowitz.
H3. We got it.
That's 10.
Yeah. That's number 10, yes?
Without objection, then.
I said object.
Oh.
You didn't hear me?
No. I haven't heard him offer it yet.
He did?
Okay, and you objected. So it has been offered and objected.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes. Representative Porter.
Technical question. Is this still going to be number 10?
Yes.
In the sequence of amendments, or?
Yes. And the only reason for that is that the others were offered at our prior meeting as amendments 1 through 9. Representative Berkowitz.
It's basically a technical amendment so we don't get into the problem of squishy interpretation, making sure that audits get dated and that rather than relying on any variation in what people might consider to be prompt notification or prompt reporting, inserted 10 days, which I believe is the standard the EPA uses.
Just said,
I'm sorry.
Yes, Representative Croft.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So it just said prompt before, and now we're putting 10 days or? Now we're putting 10 days absolutely?
Right, wherever the term promptly
gotcha.
Appears.
Do you want to speak to your objection?
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, just for clarification, my references are to section or to document H, not K.
Yes. Page 8 of the old version.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I guess that my concern about putting a time frame, and I understand the necessity to define what promptly means. I guess I'm thinking promptly might mean sooner than that as opposed to longer than that. And so I'm not comfortable with saying within 10 days because that. Let's say there is a big violation, and promptly then would mean, because of the type of violation that it would be, promptly would mean pick up the phone and call. before someone else fills it out or finds it or whatever, because otherwise then you couldn't possibly have immunity. Or it could be if it you don't want to make the report until after it's all typed up and all of those kinds of things, that 10 days might be reasonable. I guess that within 10 days would say that, but it doesn't say promptly, which I like promptly. And so because within 10 days doesn't necessarily say promptly, I would rather have mm-hmm. promptly in there, just because that kind of says what they're supposed to do. So I'll listen to the argument on this and on the other side of this issue, but that's my personal feeling right now.
Well, I too would like to promptly respond to that. But my concern is you've got two companies, and Company A is a small, almost a mom-and-pop operation, and they have a violation. They've run the audit, and it's they left the valve open too far, or they didn't set it the right ratchet, and they caught it the next day. Certainly, promptly would be a fairly short period of time. On the other hand, you've got Megalith Incorporated, and they have been doing whatever it may have been done, and their audit is, you know, like a phone book. And to say that that needs to be done within 10 days may not be practical. It may take them that long to read the audit. And so the concern is with promptly that the agency then could say, all right, or if appealed, a court could say promptly would reasonably mean a couple of days in Company A and maybe a couple of months in Company B. And to put the 10 days or at least a couple of weeks, something different from just the 10-day period. And so I have a little problem with a time fix because of the wide scope of the kinds of companies that will be involved. Representative Porter.
Maybe the promptly is the best word to have, but I'd like to hear from the sponsors to get a
real. All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Porter, members of the committee. We are, speaking on behalf of the sponsor, opposed to this amendment. And the first reason is the one that Representative Green touched on, is that audit reports vary from documents that are, you know, no thicker than this stack of papers to things that run into the thousands of pages. And, you know, if a company, say, on the size of, like, Alyeska Pipeline does an audit, I mean, you can imagine how complicated that is. And the management of the company reads it. Sometimes the legal counsel of the company will be reading it at the same time, or maybe they will read it after, you know, the upper management reviews it or whatever. But in any case, it's not hard to envision that that process can take longer than 10 days. I will say on a practical level that I requested a number of sample disclosures from the state of Texas, which I actually distributed to the staffs of the committee members, so they're probably somewhere in your packet. And there was a considerable variance, just in those four disclosures. One of them was disclosed within 2 days after the completion of the report, and the longest period was 50 days. So. And obviously there have been hundreds of those disclosures. I mean, I'd have to review them all to come up with, you know, what the average length of time has been, but there's considerable variance. What I've heard from at least two attorneys who work with corporations is that if promptly is left undefined, then the tendency is going to be erring on the side of interpreting that conservatively. And, you know, because you wouldn't want to lose immunity based on a technical disqualification that the agency just says, well, in our interpretation, we don't think that's prompt. So, and I think it's probably best to leave this as an administrative discretion where DEC has the discretion to kind of define what they think is prompt or not, given the nature of the audit and the complexity of the document.
Representative Rookberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Pauly, isn't it conceivable or isn't it common that you have a contractor-subcontractor relationship, or you have a contractor who's working with their principal employer, and there may be conditions of contracts that drive certain instances where they're required to have these audits, but because there could be a, like you have a contractor that's perhaps on the premises or working lands that are under lease, let's say, to their principal, that there may be an unclear area of responsibility, that is to say, between the contractor and the principal. And therefore, you would want to be able to talk to each other before you turn the other guy in without knowingly turning him in. So would there not be, I don't know if it's common, or is there, I can certainly conceive of an instance where there could even be a contractual obligation between a contractor and a principal that prior to any revelations of environmental audits or anything like that, that they'd at least be informed and also had an opportunity to review that.
Yep.
So, I mean, the set time frames become very problematic. And, Mr. Chairman, I'd also point out, as a matter of fact, the Labor and Commerce Committee has before it a international letter of credit issue on the UCC. And one of the targets, the topics of debate is when the payments of the monies will be actually transferred from one end to the other, even under international letter of credit. And we're going in the Uniform Act from 30 days down to 7 days. So we're talking about big bucks here. And we're talking about periods of time, which even in a monetary instance needs a certain amount of time to be able to be verified and handled in a proper manner. So 10 days just doesn't seem reasonable.
I'm not sure. Did you want me to comment on that?
If you care to. Yeah.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Representative Roper, I would just acknowledge that, yes, we do have relationships, particularly on the North Slope, where you have contractors and their principals. They each have their different responsibilities under the laws, and they each may be doing audit reports. And, yes, under this bill, they would be allowed to share those reports under you know, these without losing the privilege otherwise. And, yes, it might take some time to sort out, you know, who's got responsibility for which area.
Representative Berkowitz.
Actually, I was hoping we could hear from Zadar. She had some input in that I thought might be useful.
Sure. Janice, do you want to come forward? And
thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Janice Zadar. I'm with DEC. As to that part of Amendment Number 10 that would replace promptly with within 10 days after the audit report was completed, we share the same concerns that Representative James expressed. Sometimes promptly means less than 10 days. And if you have a situation where you have an ongoing violation that is causing harm, we want people to get right in there and get it at least stop whatever the violation is. We're talking about promptly initiating appropriate efforts to achieve compliance or within 10 days, promptly or within 10 days, initiate appropriate efforts to discontinue, abate, or mitigate the conditions or activities causing the injury. I mean, to me, that's appropriate, that those things be done promptly or within some set period of time.
Ms. Adair, would you feel that the agency, because of the discussion that's going on here, would be able to set the promptly and pass muster in some cases that it wouldn't always be within 10 days? It might be 2 days or it might be 2 weeks.
Mr. Chairman, I would agree with you, yes, that sometimes promptly might be right now. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it might be you have to order a part. We recognize it has to come in. You need to wait till spring to get the construction. But in no case can you continue this if there's injury. But to correct the problem promptly may be impacted by conditions outside your immediate control because you have to wait for mm-hmm, spring mm-hmm. mm-hmm. or what passes as spring.
Marry the body.
Representative Berkowitz.
I see the writing on the wall and
it's
saying no. So in the interest of expedience, let me withdraw this amendment.
Wimp.
what did he say?
All right, amendment number 10 has been withdrawn. That brings us to amendment number 11, also by Representative Berkowitz, H4,
Lauterbach.
This is my concern here. I move the amendment. Forget that.
There has been an objection for discussion purposes.
My effort here is to protect whistleblowers, and in the event, it's not so much for the accuracy of what's contained in the report or the report itself, but I think that if there's a whistleblower incident and there's retaliatory employment action taken, that the audit itself might be relevant material, and the whistleblower should have access to it for that proceeding.
Reporter or anyone on the objection?
I would like to hear a response from this.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Porter. Speaking on behalf of the sponsor, we are opposed to this amendment. There's a couple of concerns we have. First of all, we're adding in an entirely new element of the bill. If you look at lines 1 and 2 of the amendment, we're adding in the concept of arbitrator in here. There are some people that have problems with the fact that we've even included administrative hearing officer in the bill and that it ought to be just limited to courts. Now we're adding in the additional element of involving an arbitrator in the whole element of what you would do to overcome privilege. And I just got this amendment this morning. I haven't had time to farm this out to a lot of the lawyers who we've worked with on this bill to ask them what the impact of adding in this entire new concept of arbitrator would do to the bill. I can't speak to it, but it just concerns me. On the substance of the issue, I believe, first of all, this bill is not about whistleblowers. In my view, it neither grants or removes any rights which whistleblowers already have under separate laws. And so, my feeling is that what the amendment is doing here is kind of beyond the scope of what we're trying to do with this bill. And the final point I would make, and again, just in the interest of time, is that looking at the CS, version K, page 7, line 22, we have a provision in here under the exceptions section, where you can overcome privilege, where a court or administrative hearing officer can you can overcome privilege if it's shown that it would result in a miscarriage of justice or the denial of a fair trial to the party challenging the privilege. So in my mind, the kind of issues that are being highlighted here, such as, a discrimination against an employee, and then that employee files a suit and then claims that there's information, the only information that would prove his case is in the audit document, that would fall underneath this category, that you would need to get the privilege information, otherwise it would result in a miscarriage of justice. So with that, those are our comments.
Representative Berkowitz?
Yeah, I just note that on page 2, last line, the evidence is not, last two lines, it's not admissible as evidence or subject to discovery in a civil action. Now, that would include employment action, in my reading of this. And when you throw out a net as broadly as any civil action, whether legal or equitable, I'm just trying to make sure that the wrong fish don't get caught. And I'm fully insistent that the rights of whistleblowers be absolutely protected in these instances, because what we're saying here is we're expecting independent audit. We're in a situation here where we're cutting back on state inspection, state enforcement, and we're essentially pushing it back down to the corporations and individuals, and I want to make sure that there's no retaliation that takes place against an individual, especially in a circumstance where the individual is unable to subsequently defend him or herself. So while the mention of an arbitrator might be somewhat puzzling to the bill sponsor, sometimes these employment hearings are done with an arbitrator. It's the equivalent of a hearing officer, an administrative function, and I think it's all too often relevant that the report exists in the content of the report.
Senator Croft?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It does seem to me that the amendment, it follows the in-camera review procedures. Arbitrator is not as alarming to me as it was to the bill sponsor. It simply can mean a court substitute wherever that's appropriate under a contract I read it as roughly equivalent to hearing officer, and the in-camera review is required to be done under the appropriate rules of procedure. So whoever's doing it, they're bound by the same rules, and that language seems to be taken from the bill itself on an audit report proceeding. If the court or administrative hearing officer determines after an in-camera review consistent with the appropriate rules of procedure, so this clarifies an error. I was glad to hear the sponsor say that retaliation, discrimination, those sorts of things would likely be under the catch-all, but I'd be much more comfortable if we stated that they were under the catch-all. So I don't think it burdens the bill, and I think it helps to clarify an area, as the sponsor of the amendment said, was so broad in that we ought to say where the exceptions apply.
Representative Porter.
I would speak against the Mr. Chairman. The idea here is that we're trying to induce people to do this and not throw up a whole bunch of different things that if you do, you might get caught here, you might get caught here, you might get here. You have to look at these kind of provisions in their best light and then look at them in their worst light, and are they the subject of something that could be abused? And I can think of no more likely situation than employees who may have not received promotions or pay increases or changes in duties that they didn't like, using whatever means they have at their disposal mess with the employer. And to that extent, I like the balance that's in the bill. It says these are not to be used in civil cases, but it has an exception, and I think that would result in the exception being looked at as something serious, not some wage dispute. So I would speak against it.
Representative James.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with everything that Representative Porter just reported, and I feel comfortable with the bill, that this is not necessary. But I also agree with the sponsor in this case that this bill is not about whistleblowing. This is, in fact, I believe, a bill that will try to make whistleblowing not an issue. I think it takes care of the problem that creates whistleblowing. I guess I just, for a statement, I have to say that the whole term of whistleblowing is distressing to me. And I'll have to tell you what I told my kids as they were growing up. Don't tattle unless it's a life and death matter. You know, see how they define that. They'd say, is this a life and death matter? But in any event, I feel very strongly about whistleblowing being a serious offense, or else you don't get involved.
Senator Berkowitz.
Just a brief response. It's interesting to me that the assumption is it's the individual employee who stepped forward is the one who's stepping out of line in a whistleblowing circumstance. And it might indeed be a life and death situation rather than the company that's responsible being the one that is not adhering to the rules. I mean, the good, honorable companies that I think Representative Porter was describing, Representative James was thinking of, they're not going to be in a situation with the whistleblower, because they're going to be complying with the rules. The whistleblower provision I'm trying to make here is for those companies that don't pay attention to the rules. We're already in a situation with this grant of immunity where we're telling people who have broken the law, confess, all is forgiven. Now, if we were to apply that provision to the criminal code, I think we'd see an entirely different result. But here I'm saying, in those instances where the corporation is misbehaving, and in those instances where the corporation is taking retaliation against somebody, that person should have recourse to facts when we get to the point where it has to go to court. That's all I'm saying. I'm not saying that good companies should be pilloried in wrongful cases. They're still subject to in-camera review. They're still subject to all the protections that a corporation is entitled to in a suit. It's only in those instances where the corporation has done something wrong, or where there's a good ground to suspect that they've done something wrong, that the whistleblower protection would kick in. It is not a blanket exemption for whistleblowers, and I recognize again that this bill is not about whistleblowing. It's about protecting the environment. My understanding, that's the sponsor's intent. Whistleblowers are one last line of protecting the environment. And I would urge my colleagues here to look at this amendment in that light, not in any other light.
Representative Croft.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to note that on the amendment we have, amendment number 11, the line numbers are just three. You just add three to each of them. So on page one of the amendment, it's page seven, line one of the amendment, page seven, line six, and on down, translating from H to K.
Uh-huh.
So it's line 18 instead of 15 and line 23 instead of 20.
Thank you. That's appreciated. Aren't whistleblowers currently afforded some protection? Seems like the outgrowth of the TAPS line that there was some, I haven't followed it, but it seemed like there was some degree of protection given as an outgrowth of that.
If I may.
Yes, Representative Croft.
Had some experience in it. My experience is it's very specifically defined. There's no, to my knowledge, generic whistleblower standards used. In certain areas of the law, there are certain ones.
Representative Porter.
I guess I can't resist. I'm certainly not, by speaking against this amendment, I'm speaking to the fact that there are some excellent situations where whistleblowers are doing the right thing. But unfortunately, there are some situations where whistleblowers are not whistleblowers. They're trying to CYA and all those kinds of things. And I think I remember some discussion of Mr. Hazelwood in that regard at this table.
Yes, I believe there was. Any other discussion? Is the objection maintained?
Yes.
We have a roll call vote, please.
Representative Bundy? Representative Porter?
No.
Representative Roper?
No.
Representative James?
No.
Representative Croft?
Yes.
Representative Berkowitz?
Yes.
Chairman Green?
No. Amendment number 11 fails. And that brings us to amendment unnamed. Take a brief at ease. First amendment of a group of amendments that are unnamed. Where did these come from? Okay.
We only have about a minute left.
Let's probably, that's a good idea, Representative James, that while we sort through these to make sure we're getting the right one, we don't have time to really discuss them. So we will stand in recess till 5:30. House Judiciary Committee at 6:15. We were dealing with CS for Senate Bill 41 when we went on recess. And we are down to, by my count, 5 or perhaps 6 amendments. 6?
Sure, non-controversial.
Okay. I understand now that at least one of the two that were controversial in our package of 9 has been rectified, or at least modified, to the point where both the sponsor and the department are in agreement. And that would be 3A of our original of our original package, which is now called 3A.
Is that right? Is
it? And this has now been expanded to a B and C. I guess B has been interjected, and B now is called C.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Croft.
Just briefly speak to it.
Yes.
I think there was a disagreement, possibly confusion about, there's really two different standards of proof when this happens. One, what you have to do to get the judge to look at it in camera, and the next, what the judge has to decide to reveal it to the public. And it should be, and it is under this, it is in other areas of privilege. Pretty easy to get to, it's a relatively low burden to say, Judge, we think an exception might apply, you take a look. But then you still have, the judge has to find that it fits this crime or fraud or whatever exception. And the burden of proof is rightly placed on the person who wants to reveal it. So relatively easy to get a judge to look at it, pretty difficult to get a judge to reveal it to the public. And that's the line that they were troubled with, and they did a good job of drawing that line here.
So from a layman's standpoint, conceivably you can get in the door, but you may not win the case.
And nothing is revealed, you just have a judge who's sworn to secrecy looking at it. Yeah. That's
and
the door you get.
There is agreement among the two warring factions prior to this. Is there
What procedure do we have to do now? Did we turn the other one down? What did we do?
No, we just ignored it. We bypassed it.
Has it been moved?
No.
Oh, it hadn't even been moved.
No.
Oh, okay.
So if we move and adopt this, we're home free because we didn't deal with the old Amendment 3. We talked about it, but we bypassed it.
We talked about it before it was moved, huh?
Yeah.
I get so few victories, I'll move Amendment 3A.
3A has been moved.
We don't want it to second it, too.
Is there objection to Amendment 3A?
Withdraw my objection.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure which amendment you're on. So
we're on the 30. Old package 3. It's now called 3A. And before you got here, it in brief was described that there are two standards now. One, to say that there is a very good likelihood that what has happened should be reviewed, and if the judge says, okay, let's take a look at it, that doesn't mean that the judge agrees with the person who is saying that. They have to show that then after they've gotten the judge's attention that, yes, indeed, there was a problem. So it's a two-step rather than a one big step. And both the maker of the bill and the agency are in agreement with this modification.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate that. I have no objection.
All right. Hearing no objection, 3A is adopted.
Thank you, Don.
And thank you, everyone who helped work that through. Look at this.
Thank you.
Hey, do you do Windows, too?
That brings us to Amendment 9, which was the last of the original package, and we did not review this one either. I mean, so this will be the first shot at Amendment 9, which begins page 7, line 27. Everybody have that? It should be in a package.
Whose amendment is this?
Administration, is it yours? Okay.
Whose?
The administration's. DEC.
I didn't know they can move amendments in your committee, Mr. Chairman.
I'll move it.
It was
Dennis Berkowitz's amendment, okay.
That's much better. That follows our rules. Okay.
Don't let the governor be sitting
no,
at our table, do you?
We don't indeed. That's a good point. Thank you. You have moved Amendment 9. Representative Berkowitz, is there objection?
Object for purposes of discussion here. Number one, Mr. Chairman, what is the what version is this?
This is in the new package. You have a five amendment.
What version is it?
It's nine. Oh, this would be H amendment.
Just add three lines, I think.
Unless it's been modified.
I just
okay, so it is K.
This is K.
Well, the citation here is to H. H7, line 27. It should be. That's the H. It should be page 7, line 30.
I just want to look at the right spot there.
No, you're right, Representative Berkowitz.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is H.
So if you change number 9 to say page 7,
up by
line
three.
30. Yeah. Or page 7, line 30. And then page 7, lines 27 to 29.
Confusion reigns supreme. Is everybody with us now?
Mm-hmm. But can we find out what the sponsor believes on this? I mean, what their position is?
That is actually to page 8, line 1.
And then it's deleting page 7, lines 30 through 31, and page 8, line 1 on the new version.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, instead of page 8. It's all moved down 3, but it skips to the next
page. You have to go to the next page. Okay. All right. Representative Berkowitz.
Maybe if there's someone in the audience that could help me with this.
Yes, please come forward and identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. My name is Marie Sansone. I'm an assistant attorney general here in Juneau. And this amendment grew out of a meeting that Janice Adair from DEC had with the Environmental Protection Agency. She had asked the regional council in Seattle to review the bill, and they had also secured review from the EPA headquarters in Washington. And they had very few concerns, but this was one of them, which for the purposes of convenience is what we've called the fruit of the poisonous tree problem. That being that when you have a disclosure or have evidence that discloses a violation, sometimes an issue can come up when you discover subsequent violations. Do they stem from this initial disclosure? Are they tainted somehow so that there couldn't be immunity? And they were concerned with the clause in here. You can get immunity for the facts, for the violations you disclose. You could disclose, for example, I violated laws X, Y, and Z, and those would be the ones that you might get immunity for. And we also have language in here that allows you to disclose a factual scenario or circumstances, conditions, and occurrences, and as long as you disclose that and it meets the other criteria of the bill, you can receive immunity for that, even though you don't specifically identify what violation that is. So you could disclose, we observed oil stains on the ground, and you don't have to disclose that you violated the law against spilling oil and not cleaning it up and not reporting. But that, as long as you meet all the other conditions, you'll get immunity for that. The concern then is, well, what happens if there should be later discoveries by the agency or by the municipality of violations? They might, several years later, decide we need to look at whether this company has cleaned this up. Have they corrected this problem to keep it from recurring? Do they have staining in other areas that they didn't audit? And we felt that that was really outside the scope of what was intended by the bill and shouldn't be immunized. But by leaving that last clause in there, it kind of creates an ambiguity. That ambiguity is to some extent cured by the language that talks about making the disclosure of the violation of the law or the circumstances, conditions, or occurrences. But we felt in our conversations with the EPA that we have a higher comfort level just deleting that last clause. And I do believe the sponsor objects to this amendment.
I'm not surprised. I would imagine the sponsor would like to make his own statement, but does everybody understand where Marie is coming from?
Nope.
Okay, Marie, would you care to restate that?
Certainly. This paragraph A or subsection A in the voluntary, this is the initial paragraph in this section. And so it's an introduction into what you can obtain immunity for. So an owner-operator who comes forward and makes a voluntary disclosure of a violation of an environmental law, he can disclose the actual law that's being violated by reference. For example, I violated Alaska Statute 4603-720A because, he can set that out. Or he may come in and not actually identify the law, but describe circumstances, conditions, or occurrences that constitute or could constitute the violation. So he might come in and say, I did an audit and I found I had, I looked on the ground and there were areas where I saw oil staining. I observed I had a pipe that was leaking. The auditor found that a certain machine was emitting black smoke. And that he may not identify exactly what law, regulation, or permit condition that's a violation of. However, as long as he meets all the other requirements of the bill, he can be immunized, obtain the immunity from the penalty. So the the language here then goes on to say that he can obtain immunity for the violation disclosed. In other words, he violated Alaska Statute 4603, 720 or something like that. He can obtain immunity for a violation based on the facts disclosed. He says, I observed black smoke, and DEC says, well, that would be a violation of the provision in the regulations that you can't be emitting black smoke, toxic smoke. And the question then comes up, what about this last clause for a violation discovered because of the disclosure that was unknown to the owner or operator? And our amendment proposes here the deletion of that last clause. So he would be limited to essentially the four corners of his disclosure, what he disclosed, whether he disclosed it through a description or whether he actually identified the specific regulations that he believed he was violating. Now, the problem with the last clause is that it could, if it's subject to abuse, it could cover violations well beyond any disclosure. He might have disclosed he had oil stains on one site. Later on, DEC is inspecting another site. They remember that he had problems at one site, and they look for this at the other site. Is that really is not intended to be immunized within any of the purposes of this bill that's ever been discussed. It's well beyond anything he's disclosed. But the concern is that the owner-operator could make the argument, well, the only reason you bothered to look was you knew I disclosed this violation 2 years ago about my one property, and you'd never would have thought to look at my other property if you hadn't known that. That's a concern that the EPA has raised, that somehow that discovery of the subsequent violation that was never disclosed, and there were no facts about it that were ever disclosed, would somehow get pulled into the immunity section. I don't know if that's any more clear.
Well, I understand where you're coming from now, and I've read this again, and I don't get it that way. Talking about the same situation, it would appear to me that with the rest of the bill and how this self-audit works, that from your example that you gave, was that because they looked at this other place and found something over there, he's saying, well, you wouldn't have looked at it because if I hadn't have done it over here. It appears to me that if he didn't do an audit on that place over there, that he has no immunity. And I can't see where that could be stretched that far. Now, had he done an audit over there and found the same things, what I think this really means is that if they found this oil spilled and that there was a black smoke coming out, and so then they looked and they saw oil maybe coming out of the piece of equipment or whatever, and so he assumed, looked around, and that's where this oil spill came from, and he reported that, disclosed it, and said what he's doing. Meanwhile, it turns out that there may have been two sources of oil which he overlooked, didn't know that, and disclosed it properly, and then you find that, well, that wasn't the cause that he disclosed a different cause. And so that seems to me like that's what we're talking about here, is that if the violation was discovered because of this disclosure and you come back to check to see if they had complied and they hadn't and found out that what he reported wasn't what the cause was, and he didn't know about it. Here it sees that they have to unknown to the owner at the time that they made the disclosure. It seems to me like the fact that because of his disclosure it did find it, that he surely ought to still have the immunity and opportunity to clean it up. So I guess I read this, using your example, a little different than what you do. I would think that if there's two sites and if he's going to audit and be having immunity, he has to audit both of them.
Well, I would think that I fall in the same line of reasoning that Representative James says, because in one case, in the example you give, this sounds like there may be intent involved, and yet we talked earlier about there's going to have to be some trust. And when it says unknown to the owner, that means to me that he has come forth and said, here is a problem I found. And so in good faith, he's told you that, and the agency gets together with him, and oh my gosh, here's something else. It seems to me that because it was unknown to him, and it was only found because of his decision to come forth with this other evidence, neither the agency nor the operator would have known about this other. And if our true intent is to clean up the environment and to correct environmental problems, we should allow that rather than have that always as a cloud hanging over your head. So I think if both the agencies and the operators are truly looking for a better environment, they would want to leave this in. I think Representative Croft is up next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the amendment would... I'm somewhere between the prior two speakers, and I'm trying to figure it out. The setup that Representative James talked about, I disclose here on one site, that causes them to wonder whether some other things might be going on other sites, and through the normal lengthy process, check it out and find. I haven't immunized myself for everything that might be found later, just because I draw their attention. So what Representative James said about if you want to be immunized for both sites, make a disclosure for both sites, comforts me very much. And I think that it would be better with this amendment. But even if we reject it, I'm glad to put on the record that as the legal terminology goes, the fruit of the poisonous tree doesn't extend that far. It doesn't extend to things that aren't somehow related in a location sense, in a logical sense, to the original violation.
Representative Rookwood.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess my concern is that I look at this as almost a constructive amnesty, if you will, and that's really the intention of the bill. If we have an opening here, and if the operator does want to undertake the audit, this is the intent of the bill to encourage that. So this, in essence, would be what I call constructive amnesty, and I think that's a good thing. I'm very concerned about positing the issue in a time frame. Because is there nothing else in the mitigation in the bill that, particularly if there's intentional disregards or other things here, that would overcome that? I mean, as Representative Croft says, puts certain things on the record. I think we need to have on the record that there is no, if something's done in 2 years or 3 years, it doesn't really make any difference, the way I read this. But are there not other safeguards? And maybe I should be directing this to the bill sponsor rather than.
The chair, Representative Rookwood, there are many safeguards in this bill, and the sponsor has been very cooperative in working with us to make sure that they're appropriate. We wanted to bring this to your attention because it was a concern raised by the EPA attorneys, and this is one solution that would address their concern in a very literal way. We did feel the bill had quite a lot of protections against abuse, against people misusing the bill or extending it too far. And I think with the record indicating that there's, a sense of that you can't get one disclosure does not allow you to immunize just countless unrelated violations, I think we have a very clear record on that, and that will provide the same protections that we were trying to seek through this amendment.
It seems to me sections B and C would impose the protection of the environment, because immunization wouldn't work if it's a threat to substantial injury or one of those things. And then we go on to say in C that disclosure must be done, we were talking about 10 days, but certainly promptly. And so that, I think, would do away with the two-year problem, because if you've made the disclosure and come back 2 years later and say, oh, by the way, this has been found, therefore we have immunization, I don't think that certainly follows the intent here.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure I should bring this up, but it was brought up by a witness yesterday. It's about it's a typical thing in a real estate transaction where you have an existing piece of real property that has POL or petroleum type dumping on it, and there's the requirement for the remediation of that prior to the sale of that property. But then the actual cause or the timing of that could be a number of years. A substantial amount of if you will, polluted or impaired real estate in this state and throughout the country. And that's one of the areas we're getting at. And I'm not sure how this fits in here, but I think that's a concern I have. Some of these things could have occurred previously. And if I was going to buy the parcel, I would want to go in and do a self-audit and say, hey, this is a problem here, whether it's been identified or not. And I want to try to clean it up, help me figure out how to do that, so I can be in compliance, but don't penalize me for bringing it to your attention.
Well, and I think the way it's written, that would happen.
Good.
Okay. Because I think when you bring that to the agency's attention, that I have a polluted piece of ground here, and help me determine, can I do it by aeration? Do I have to do it by digging it up and burning it or flushing it or whatever? The clock is, I mean, you've satisfied the conditions here. And I think you do get immunization. Excuse me, Representative Croft.
And I think that's exactly right. For things reasonably within the scope of that disclosure, doesn't mean that every piece of property you own is immunized.
Any other discussion on amendment number 9? Is the objection maintained?
Yes.
We have a roll call vote, please.
Bundy?
Pass.
Representative Porter? Representative Roper?
No.
Representative James?
No.
Representative Croft?
Yes.
Representative Berkowitz?
Yes.
Chairman Green?
No.
Representative Bundy?
No.
Amendment 9 has failed.
Wouldn't have made any difference.
That brings us, yeah. It would have. Would have died for a time.
No. The amendment.
The amendment would have died.
It dies. Uh-huh.
Oh, I see what he's saying. The outcome wouldn't have been different.
No. Hot ones and one good. So I was getting, I had a separate
this brings
file
us,
for amendment.
This brings it. Third time. This brings us to Amendment 12A, which, again, is... Are these also the agency?
Somebody own up.
They were Marie's initially.
I don't think this is at least a different kind of writing.
Do we have a member of the board? Excuse me, a member of the committee?
We have several board
who
members.
Will offer Amendment 12A?
I'll offer Amendment 12A.
No, Jack.
Okay.
Who's the member?
I would imagine, Marie, we're going to want you back up here. Would you, unless Representative Berkowitz would...
Well, we can look it up and see what this is.
I'm quite happy to defer to someone who knows what they're talking about.
Marie, can you give us a what's for on this amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Now, this now applies to K, these lines.
Yes, it certainly fits anyway.
Representative Croft.
I understand that the next three amendments are not objectionable, and if that's the case, maybe we could ask Mr. Pauly to join us and we could expedite things, if that's
that
true.
Sounds like a winner to me.
Next.
12, 13, and 14.
The next three amendments were prompted by... information that Bob Bundy, or some of the concerns that Bob Bundy, the United States Attorney, had included in his letter. And he was concerned about one of the issues he raised was, could you use the self-audit information in any way during an agency follow-up inspection? And one area of the bill that talks about this is in the proposed section 09-25 450, which creates the audit privilege, and in subsection A, it starts out that unless the privilege has been waived under 455A, which is a provision that allows owners and operators to expressly waive the privilege at their own wish without any purpose, or a disclosure is made under 455B, which in the context of a government agency was under a claim of confidentiality that the disclosure is not is kept confidential under the Public Records Act, that if there had been a disclosure under either scenario, a government agency could use the audit report during a subsequent inspection. So in looking through the bill, I realized that another type of disclosures can be made by the owner-operator in the context of the immunity sections, which are this 475 and 480, and that we could help address some of Mr. Bundy's concerns by inserting a reference to those sections in the bill. Now, most likely, an owner-operator in an immunity situation, if they make a disclosure, they will either come out and expressly waive the privilege under 455A, or they will prepare the claim of confidentiality statement. But this would possibly cover anything that might slip through the cracks. So these are disclosures that are allowed and recognized under the statute.
Excuse me, Marie, could we hold off just one second when we change the page?